Today we're going to have an oral history of the real estate business of Morehead, Minnesota. I am the interviewer. I am Mrs. Andrea Munn, and I have the pleasure today of interviewing James Fay. James is president of the Ammerland Real Estate of Fargo and Morehead and the surrounding territory. Now, Jim, you are a Morehead native, and your business is in Fargo, but you handle all this area. Is that true?
Right. The Ammerland Company was started about, 1899 or 1900 by John and Henry Ammerland. Like a lot of people, I've always worked in out of a Fargo office.
Yes.
In fact, I think about one time I checked up on it, Ruth, and there were about 30% of the realtors that belonged to Fargo firms that lived in Morehead. So it's not unusual to have a Morehead person.
Yes. Basically, working out of Fargo. You're Morehead. Your roots.
Very deep, aren't they?
Yeah. Yes.
My grandfather, came to Morehead in, I think it was 1873.
And his name was?
That was Edward Fay, and let's call him Edward Fay Sr., because after being a conductor on the stagecoach, he had to run from Morehead to Fort Garry, which, of course, is Winnipeg. And I don't really know. You'd have to look at some of my dad's writings to know how long he had that run. But after the stagecoach, then he was a postmaster twice in Morehead, and I think in looking at history, it was something like 1882 to 1886, and then 1896 to 1900. I'm off a little bit there, but he was the postmaster, certainly one of the first postmasters in Morehead. And then I had an uncle who also was in the post office, and that would be Ed Fay Jr., And he was
his son.
Yep, that would be my uncle, was an assistant postmaster for quite a few years. And then my dad, who started in the post office in 1902 and retired in 1948, also was in the post office. And then on top of that, my aunt was worked back in the registry postal savings department, if you remember, on the end of the what is now the Red River Art, and the registry window was out.
And what was her name?
That was Anna Fay.
And
you remember Anna Fay?
Very much.
Sure.
And she was a little older than your father,
yes.
Jim Fay.
Yep, a few
you
years
were
older.
You were named for your father.
Yep. My dad was born in 1883, and the Fay house was up on, that would be the 100 block of 3rd Street North. I didn't know really where that house had been until Urban Renewal came along, and I was one of the commissioners involved in trying to settle differences in appraisal value and what people wanted for their homes. When I went through this very, very old house and sometime talking to my dad about that, he said that's where our home was. So this very old house that I was going through was the replacement for the original Fay house.
I see.
I don't really know when the Fay house was torn down, and by now
it is gone.
Oh, it was gone long before this old house I was going through was built on that site.
Mm-hmm.
So it was up in the Point area, as the old timers called that original part that was first built for Morehead. It would be on either side of First Avenue North from 4th Street West to the river. Let's say the present site of the American Crystal headquarters, and north of there. See where they're talking about building the Holmes place and Riverside One.
Yeah.
Anyhow, so my dad was there in the post office, from, 1902 to 1948, and then he retired because at that point he was 65 years old, and he retired from the post office. They couldn't retire as early as they do now. And Anne, I think, probably, Anne hadn't started as early as Dad, but she retired soon after Dad did in 1948. I don't really remember when Anna retired. But Anna had always lived with my mother and Dad most of my life. She hadn't always lived with them, but most of my life she lived with them. So I was very close to her. Knew her very well. She passed away, I think, about 1973 or 2. It's terrible, but I don't really remember that date. And she was down at St. Francis in Breckenridge.
Oh, she was,
yeah.
Yes.
And my mother was living at Eventide when she passed away in 72. Anna passed away after that. And my dad just didn't wake up one morning. Basically, went out to visit my sister in California and in San Jose. And one Sunday morning, I think it was December 19th, 1969, and Dad just, he'd passed away during the night. He was 85 years old. But as you know, he had a great memory.
Yes.
And then besides
yes.
that, they, after he retired from the post office, he worked as a bailiff up in the courthouse. And then he started writing, reminiscing with Jim Fay in the Moorhead Daily News. And, of course, that put him back
it into was called
Reminiscing with Jim
mm-hmm,
Fay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, it made him remember some things he might not have. And if you remember, he had a great memory.
Very.
He'd really tell you what year certain things happened.
Yes.
For me, being in the real estate business, I could say to him, who lived at 418 Fifth Street South? And that was happened to be the house they built in 25, 3 years before I was born in 1928.
Now, who built that house?
That was built by Melvie.
Oh, Melvie, your father have it built for him.
He
himself.
Had it built. Yeah,
he had
Melvie build it for
him
on some of that land that Nellie Hopkins had held.
Right.
I think that's Hopkins sub of Earl's Hopkins addition. I forget the exact legal. But anyhow, I could ask my dad an address, and he would be able to tell me who built it and who had ever lived there. And, of course, that came about because of the post office. You know,
he'd have everybody's name and address.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was terrible. Tell you how many children
Wonderful.
There were, too.
And how old are you, Jim?
I'm now 56. I'll be 57 on June 4th. So just about
3
weeks
away.
What year were you born? I was born 1928.
Yes.
Yeah. And I got out of Moorhead High in 1946. And I played ball there for Cliff Holmrest, who had been an all-state ball player for Moorhead High when they won their first basketball title in 1928, the same year I was born. So I played football and basketball for Cliff, and then he broke his back in the fall of 45. And
Cliff
Holmrest.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, and then Peg Mattson, who is the ball field in North Moorhead, is named after him. Peg had come to Moorhead the year before, and we finished up playing basketball for him. And I was captain of the basketball team. I always thought we were going to win the state tournament that year, but we got beat by Crosby Ironton by 2 points in the regional final. After high school, I went to the end of the Army for about 2 years and sat around a little bit. In fact, I went moose hunting with Ralph Withnell into Canada in the fall of 49. So I didn't start at NDSU until January of... I went to moose hunting in the fall of 48, and I started in January of 1949 at North Dakota State. And there my major was geology. It was fine until I found out I really couldn't sit in a laboratory very long.
Yeah.
And most geologists start out of school in labs for petroleum companies and such as that. So I ended up with a major in econ, economics. And graduated from North Dakota State in 1953. I stayed through the fifth basketball season, because by then I'd quit playing basketball, but I did manage. And I coached the freshman 1 year out at North Dakota State.
Oh, you did?
In 1951-52, I believe. Yeah, for Chuck Benson. They didn't have a lot of money in the programs in those days, so they used me as a freshman coach. In April of 53, I graduated, and then I went to work for Dun & Bradstreet in the western two-thirds of North Dakota. And found out fairly quickly I didn't want to do that the rest of my life. I liked it during the day, but I was about 25 years old, and I really didn't like working on paper records all night and then calling on people all day. So I gave them my notice and joined the Ameren Company in the middle of July of 1953.
And you were 25 years old?
I was now 20. I would, what, in 50, yes, I was 25 years old.
When you joined the Ameren Real Estate,
yeah.
The business was in Sparkle.
Right. It was located in an address called 671 2nd Avenue North. It's in where the new federal building is over in Fargo now. It was a one-story building called the Haggard Building.
I see.
And it's part of that Haggard family.
Do you remember how many people were actually employed at Ameriland when you walked
in? When I walked in the door, there were four other people there already. There was Chris Hillable, Peter Hillable, Jack Hillable, and a salesman named Jim Newlove.
If you were trained with the Hillables, that was a fine background.
Believe me. Well, it was very diverse.
Yes.
They were very imaginative people.
Yes.
And maybe I could talk about that right now. Chris Hillable, he wasn't loved by everybody, but he was especially adept at helping people get into their first home.
Yes.
We had somewhere in the neighborhood of 400 customers who paid $5 or $10 a month on second mortgages. Now, second mortgages have a bad connotation. But what Chris had worked at Ameriland Company, they had three builders building houses for them. They took out the mortgages at primarily Gate City. I think they helped make Gate City bigger after the war. We had people with $250 and $500 down who obviously didn't have the 20% down, which was the normal full down payment, because lenders could only go to 80%.
And this was what year?
This was 1953.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we had around 400 people there at one time making these second mortgage payments. Now, these second mortgages had no due date. They didn't have a date at which you had to go out and refinance your first mortgage. So the people really could pay 20 years on it. Nobody could ever force them to refinance their first mortgage. And that I always thought, as I watched other people later on develop second mortgages, was a unique feature of the way Chris Hillable had it going, because these people would never be forced to refinance and go to a higher rate on their first mortgage. And what he would eventually do is they accumulated a little more worldly goods. He'd give them a discount on their second mortgage if they wanted to pay him up. And there were just an awful lot of people who got started that way. In fact, I have one couple, they've now retired and gone to Texas, who bought 8 homes in their lifetime here, 7 of them through me. I told them they can't retire and move to Texas. I mean,
yes.
Depending on you to buy another one. But he started those people out with a very small down payment.
Thrifty.
It gave them a chance to own a home instead of being a tenant.
Yeah.
Now, you talk about what the market looked like in 1953. We were still suffering from a shortage of housing that had, of course, built up at the end of World War II when all the veterans came home, started families, and there hadn't been any building during World War II, of course, relatively speaking. In fact, Chris Hillable, and he had a brother, Al. Chris and Al Hillable had bought the Ameriland Company from the last of the Amerilands. There was the widow of John or Henry Ameriland.
Yes.
In 1949. And then Al Hillable had a heart attack in December of 50, I think it was. I know I was on a trip with the Bison basketball team. I came home and Al had passed away. So it was basically Chris, and Peter was more his son, and Jack Hillable, who was the son of Al. When I started there in 53, Jack had graduated from Concordia in 50, gone in the service, and then worked a while for Ford Credit, I believe. I'm not sure, I forget the initials that they used. And started Ameriland in April of 53, and I came in July of 53. But that's how primarily Ameriland was in business, to sell the new homes that the Hillables were having being built by the three Fargo builders. And it was much less complex than it is today.
Yes.
If you had been looking at a house with me in 1953, Ruth, I might have ordered a credit report on you right now.
Yes.
I would order the credit report. I had the credit report in your file, and when you and I found the home you wanted to buy, we'd go in to make a loan app, and I'd hand the credit report to the lender. Now the lenders can't even tell us what your credit report says. If they're going to turn a loan down, they'll say, well, have the buyer call me. We'll have to have him talk to the credit bureau. So you've got some hint as to what the problem is. But just think how easy it used to be for me, because I'd have a credit report, bang, bang. I'd probably have loan approval for you later on that day. Now, I don't know whether some programs can take up to 6 weeks, and there are some programs now to get loan approval might take up to, if you got involved with the FHA in the cities, you might wait 4 months to get a loan approval.
Yes, I was going to say, a loan approval from who would that come from?
From the lender. The lender, and it used to be a verbal commitment. They say, sure, we'll give you the loan, and so you'd call the buyer and say, hey, the loan's been approved. It's much more complex now.
Yes.
Do you have some format you wish to follow?
You've covered a lot of things that I had to ask you about. You're coming into the real estate business and your history of Amerlin that you've given us, mm-hmm. and where it was located, and the type of work that you did when you went in 53, and just how would you go about selling a house in 53? You've started covering that already.
Well, primarily in
people
19...
People would come to you,
see, we didn't
of course.
Have licenses. We didn't need licenses.
Oh,
that
didn't.
Would be one thing that's much different now.
The employer would... You come to work for me, and sure. I'll give you a desk.
I'd told Dun & Bradstreet I was going to be leaving, and at the end of a month and or 2 weeks, I noticed I gave them. And so Jack Hillable, I think we were out at a Fargo Moorhead Twins game, said, well, why don't you come over to Amerlin? You might sell a house while you're looking for a job. So I walked into Amerlin on probably Tuesday, July 17th or some such date, and Chris Hillable said, well, here's a pad of listings, and here's a book with multiple listings in them, and we're going out and take a look at a house. And so I listed a house the first day, and I remember the house, and believe me, it wasn't very much, you know. But Chris said, well, what do you think?
What do you mean now by very much? Was it 11,000
no,
or
7,000?
No, I think
7, it was 6,500, this little house.
6,500, I guess pretty close,
but
didn't
Chris
I?
Was great at putting an ob. Well, 6,500 wasn't getting you much house even in 1953. We were building new houses, a little what we call expansion, two-bedroom story and a half, with the half story unfinished, and without a garage, and those were selling at about $9,800 in those days. Now, you probably had about $1,500 in special assessments in those new areas, because Hillable Terrace was a brand-new addition, just being paved, in fact, and some of the specials got over $2,000, which was really a lot of money when you compare the house at $9,800 and the specials at 2,000, just think,
yes.
You know, 20% of the total, what you were paying for it, you also had 20% more in specials, so that added up to a lot of money. He just handed me the pad, and he said, here's a listing book. They were in a leather binder in those days, individual sheets, and we went out and looked at this house, and I went through it with Chris, and he said, what do you think it's worth, Jim? Well, it could have been $1,000,000, or it could have been $10. I had no background to know.
No.
So
you learned by experience.
Oh, he was great at putting the work on your back and just walk away from you and expect you to do it. He did that later to me, you know, in about 1960. By then, I'd done pretty well at becoming good at finding homes for people, and Urban Renewal was coming into Fargo. Always Urban Renewal came in with public housing. Now, nowadays you might call it elderly or handicapped or anything else, or high-rise, but mm-hmm. up until that point, if you had Urban Renewal, you automatically had to accept public housing. And the realtors in Fargo really fought it, and it got down to a meeting with the mayor, Herschel Askowitz, and the board of realtors, and somebody had to bend a little bit to provide housing for the people who are going to be displaced by the demolition of this Urban Renewal area. And the Board of Realtors had said they would sign an agreement guaranteeing decent, safe, and sanitary housing, and suddenly some of them started getting nervous, and Chris said Amerlin will sign it.
Yes.
So Amerlin signed the contract with the federal government guaranteeing decent, safe, and sanitary housing, and Chris just said Jim will take care of it.
Uh-huh.
And I think if you were reading the forum, you would see that at some point somebody interviewed me a few years ago or right after that. And,
yes.
And I got, they said, you know, how was it? And I said, I would never want to go through that again, because we were dealing with people who not only, many of them did not have jobs, didn't want to have jobs, didn't take care of where they lived, and we had to go find them decent, safe, and sanitary housing in a building owned by somebody else, and then underwrite the rent to be sure that mm-hmm. that they paid it. So that was probably put a few years on my back in a hurry.
Yes.
But again, I, you know, we got through it, and all the other, most of the other realtors all pitched in, and we created a fund, and each month we subsidized people. But we did create an urban renewal district in Fargo without public housing.
Right. Mm-hmm. We'll back up a little.
Yeah.
When you took your first position with it was called Ammerland. It was really the Hillebos that were operating it at that time. You came in. He just invited you in to start working. How would you hire someone today in 1985 if you were to add them to mm-hmm. your firm?
Well,
what kind of qualifications would a young man need? Or a middle-aged man.
Yeah, but nowadays it's more than 50% female.
More than, all right, you'd hire lady. Or
yes, young man or young lady. Any person, man
any
or
person.
Woman. I think most, you started, certainly
they
start out
they have training courses for these people to sell real estate.
Now they have mandatory courses that they uh-huh. must go through, Ruth, before they can even take the test. They
I
have
see.
You have pre-examination hours that you must take.
To see how qualified you are?
The pre-examination courses are going to cover real estate law. There's a certain amount of mathematics in it. There's a certain amount of contract law. And because real estate is a very simple but complex business.
Yes.
And there's, for the agents who are out on the streets, you really have to have a lot of knowledge besides just being able to drive them around and find one they like. I think the biggest thing that the agent does for the seller is we're available, it seems like, 7 days a week. I try not to be available Friday night or Saturday night because I have to have some time. Otherwise, I expect your agent to be available at any time so that the owner of the property, especially with now both husband and wives working,
yes.
that the agent is there to show the property at any hour of the day, whether anybody's home or not. And they expect qualified people to be shown the house, people who
yes.
have an income, have a job.
Extremely trustworthy.
Right. And credit, you know, that they're capable of buying the house.
Mm-hmm.
Not all agents do that qualifying. It's a certainly kind of, you handle everybody differently. I try not to bombard new people with say, now you got to qualify these people. Sometimes you have to find out, do they have a job? Do they have the down payment? What are problems are going to come if they pick out a house? In other words, credit. So when you're talking mm-hmm. I don't think there's no format that I've watched over the years to tell you who a good real estate agent, you know, a realtor, if they belong to the National Association of Realtors. There's no way to know who's going to be good at it.
But they do have to belong to that.
We won't hire anybody at the Ammerlin Company who won't join the National Association of Realtors.
No.
And we now have what's called 100% boards, in which if you want to be a realtor, all of your people must also belong to the National Association of Realtors. But all real estate licensed brokers and agents are not realtors. The realtor is the person who belongs to the National Association
yes.
of Realtors, which is a, you know, a trademark coined phrase which we're supposed to capitalize. I get mad at the forum, they don't always do that.
Mm-hmm.
But Ruth, I don't, interviewing people, I don't think age has a bit of anything to do with getting somebody in the real estate business.
Years ago either.
Right.
A retired person could go, an active retired
do a great
person
job.
Would enjoy real estate.
Right. As long as they don't mind the phone ringing all the time and having a lot of disappointments.
Well, how many hours a week do they want to spend on it? They'd be satisfied with a house now and then.
Yes, and that's we've got a lot of those people.
Sure.
Thinking about history, when I started, you know, there was a Moorhead Board of Realtors and there was a Fargo Board of Realtors.
Yes.
And we had a multiple listing service in Fargo. I looked to see who the original people were, and they were all Fargo firms.
Yes.
But over on the Moorhead side of the river, of course, Liv Nemzik was still around.
That's right. He was a real estate man following his Moorhead State College retirement.
Yes. He was a developer. You know, South Acres Edition, which was land property. Well, yes,
industrial
bringing it into
park,
the city, getting it accepted, sure.
That type of thing.
Yes. I never saw Sliv trying to sell a home. He'd sell the land to the builders.
Yes.
Martin Johnson, you know, the FM Hotel. Martin
yes.
was still very active, but he was basically farmland, so we didn't see him in brokerage.
Well, that's an important part today, too, isn't it? Country and farmland.
Yes,
it's
primarily a specialty, and I don't deal in it.
No.
I can't tell wheat from oats.
But does that matter if it's valuable acreage?
Well, if I'm being any service to the seller, I should understand what he is trying to sell and why it's worth this much money. And if I don't understand the product at all, I'm back to being a beginner.
But then on the other hand, if he could show you the valuable crops that he had
mm-hmm.
off and on for the last 15 mm-hmm. years, that would indicate how valuable a land is,
oh,
right?
True. Like but why
Red
not
River
hire
Valley.
Somebody who is who deals
yes,
in farmland
yes.
to help you market it or to help you find it? I just, if I were a buyer, I'd prefer to be dealing with somebody who understands farmland. Because
yes.
I may not know all the questions, and he may think of some things I should want to know. And that's why you as a buyer should deal with me, because you may not think of some things that I'll think of as we look at homes, rather than you finding out later that, hey, I didn't buy a very good one. You know, if there's a pre-existing condition or quality, you want me to be able to point it out to you, so that you aren't disappointed later on.
In a house,
yeah. I'm not a builder, but
mm-hmm.
you know, I guess I listen well, and I certainly am trying to find a house that will have the features you want. But also in Moorhead, then Jamie Nye was around. J.W. Nye, he passed away a couple years ago.
Yes.
He had Nye Realty. That would be a name that would
ring a bell. A Moorhead name.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I don't think he was in relation to old Judge Nye, though, the original Nye in Moorhead. I might be wrong.
Could be. The name is not common.
No, there aren't too many Nyes around. But Jamie was around. Now, Bud Kwame, Kwame Realty, you know, they were about what Dick and Bert were building. Watson Realty was already in existence. Les Watson built up quite an organization.
Moorhead.
These are all Moorhead firms.
Yes.
Les Watson was the head. Bob Moritz, who is now your county county assessor. Chuck Watson, who is, I think, maybe just retired as a teacher in the Moorhead system, was
That's
a Watson
right.
Realty then. And Norm Fay, who is spelled F-E-A-Y, Norm Fay was with Watson.
And where is he now? Is he in
real
estate?
Well, Norm's, he's been in real estate in both sides of the river, and he owned a motel up in Mayville until about a year ago, and then he moved back here, and he came back to work for us last year, but he said it's just the financing has gotten so complex he didn't enjoy it.
I see.
And so he's out of real estate again. Viking Realty was around. That was Warren Gutaw, you know, and Vic Anderson. Now, this would be the older Vic Anderson, and I think he's SEN. He had children that I grew up with. And
Vic Anderson?
Yeah, the older one now. Vic is still alive. Mrs. Anderson passed away a couple years ago, but then there was another Vic Anderson had been the mobile station owner on A Street and Main Avenue. Started Anderson Real Estate with his wife, was it Elaine, or I think, and then moved his office later to Fargo. But And then some of the current names of Wagner Realty. Lowell Wagner right. went to work for Jimmy Nye. I don't remember the year, but I remember him coming there. And Dennis Olson came into the business and had Olson Real Estate until a few years ago. And he's now with First Realty in Fargo. Well, we had two multiples at one. When I came into the business, the Fargo Board of Realtors had a multiple listing service.
And they still have a multiple listing.
Oh, yes. And we have the original one. I mean, it's never failed. And nobody else in North Dakota can say that. We had about, there were 12, 13 or 14 signees of that first agreement to cooperate with each other. And since then, quite a large book of rules and regulations has evolved. The ones who came into multiple from Moorhead, Nye originally was, another multiple started up, probably had seven or eight members, but they fought so much that it finally just fell by its own failure, and those members joined the Fargo Board of Realtors and became a part of what we eventually called RMLS. We've now disbanded that, or kind of it's a merger. We brought it more within the Fargo-Moorhead Board of Realtors. Of 1973, the Moorhead Board, I think it was January 1st of 73, the Fargo Board and the Moorhead Board of Realtors became the Fargo-Moorhead Board of Realtors. And since then, we just have one.
And that was not affected, due to the fact that you have North Dakota and Minnesota, the...
Anybody in this business is going to be licensed on both sides of the river.
Yes.
You can't
survive.
It wouldn't make sense
no.
to cut that part of your market away from you by not being licensed. And they have reciprocity. So an agent who lives in Fargo, becomes licensed in North Dakota, mm-hmm. just sends a reciprocity statement to Minnesota and they issue a license.
Yes. Now, figure-wise, I made the little note that way mm-hmm. back in 1930, there were 7,600 people in Moorhead. And the last one I really looked at was 1970, 29,000. That would be about 30,000 people
mm-hmm.
from 7,600 to 30,000, and that would be 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
So now... you find there's many, many homes for sale, but there are many, many people looking.
We, at present, we have more inventory than we have buyers. That's been good for the buyers.
Yes.
You know,
what they call that, buyer's market?
I would say so.
Isn't that way every year.
No.
Every
in
area.
Fact, if thinking about population, Moorhead basically has not grown since 1970.
No.
And it's it reflects right back on the taxing spending policies in the state of Minnesota. It just drove very good people across the river. It really hurts me to watch families that have raised their children in Moorhead now basically need no government services, be forced to move across the river just to escape some very hard taxes on them. Some of those people are ready to retire, and if they were going to sell a business, they really had to move across the river just to get away from a very heavy tax, and I couldn't fault them. But in return, some of the welfare programs...
You're telling me that it's not the real estate house tax that's that important.
You're
it
right.
isn't,
Good.
Is it?
Thank you for pointing that out. No,
yeah.
the Moorhead real estate taxes are lower than...
Reasonable.
Fargo, North Dakota.
But if you're retired, that's nice, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
If you're living in a Moorhead house, those taxes aren't too out of line if you're going to compare it with North Dakota, Fargo, or
it's
other
the state income
places
tax.
In the nation.
It's the state income tax
the
that has hurt the
tax.
Growth of Moorhead. Look at our utility
For
rates.
The businesses,
right.
mostly.
Yeah. Well, they have business taxes that are much higher than North Dakota.
Yes.
I'm thinking people living here. We've always been a bedroom town. I have no argument with that. Moorhead is a great bedroom town, you know, two colleges, and it's been a great place to live. And it really, if you walk around and look, you'll find the streets are a little wider in Moorhead, our water's a little better. It's a great place to live, but they just finally, it became, the taxes just started pushing people over to the other side of the river. So while Fargo grew very nicely between 70 and 80, Morehead went to sleep.
Yes.
In fact, I think the 80 census, they fought that, but it showed a little decline in residents. Now, how many of those that in growth occurred because of college students that they started counting on camp, right, living here, rather than at their home address, parents' home address, let's say. That had something to do with it. But the town was really growing very nicely, and I used to get out in the mud and sell houses in the spring, you know.
I recall it very, very well, the growth that we had.
Yeah. And one of Slibs Nemzig's edition is where I live, and I had it for sale out in the mud in 1955 when I got married and bought the house before I was married. And the houses were there, but the streets were mud, you know, and you wanted to look at houses, especially the springtime. There were days when I know nobody else was showing property. I just put chains on my back tires and plowed through mud showing houses.
You'd say that the houses sold because they were reasonably priced, even with the poor roads, and you were waiting for
Morehead had
pavement.
Morehead was very good at their Morehead streets, sewer and water, were very well priced. They were much, for some reason, they were much better priced than Fargo. You would get a 65-foot lot in Morehead with asphalt, concrete curb and gutter and asphalt in front of it. I think on my lot, I'll use my lot as an example, Ruth. I think my special assessments with the street finally got in 1955 were about $1,150. Sewer, water, storm sewer, everything. The sidewalk was put in by my builder. In Fargo, for a much smaller lot, some of those specials were going over $2,000. I could never, and a narrower street never made sense to me. Morehead really had a lot of things going for it. You know, you look back to what I read about establishing that power plant and such. It was a good place to live. It's this Minnesota state income tax
that
has driven an awful lot of good people across. We get people move up here from the cities, but they'll come up and they say, no, I have to live in Fargo. Why? Taxes. Well, what they mean is state income tax. They're not looking at all the other factors that make up the cost of living. I always laugh because how does Trinity Lutheran get the greatest support of any church in the two towns when we're being taxed to death in Morehead? How do we have money to support our churches?
Which church?
Trinity Lutheran,
yes.
I think I read, had the greatest dollar support of the churches in Fargo-Morehead.
Yes. I believe that the church membership is huge.
Oh.
At Trinity Lutheran.
Mm-hmm.
The church membership is very large.
So that's a contributing factor to the
dollar volume
amount.
Helps.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I wouldn't know all the details, but the Scandinavian element, they're thrifty, they're givers.
Mm-hmm.
They're asked to give, and then they give.
Bypass other things in order to support their church.
The Trinity Lutheran pastors would agree with me. I have many good Lutheran friends, and they tell me what happens.
Would you like me to talk? I'm kind of changing the subject, but would you like me to talk about some of the builders who were building them?
Yes, and then I wanted to ask, when you're about to, sell a certain house, you are going to appraise it, aren't you?
Oh, if I'm listing your home for sale?
Yes.
The first thing is, of course, to go out and inspect it and measure it.
Sure.
Then you establish what you're working with, because most things start with size.
Sure. And when you talk about size in real estate, there are still people available who will settle for a small one-story or one-car garage.
Yes,
there's a few that'll still do that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they would like to put down the house that doesn't have a three-stall garage. They'd rather give up a yard. It's the trend of the time.
Most people started, I don't think any of my friends started out in the house they're still in. I have
one.
I'm in the real estate business. I've never moved. I've owned at least 20 other homes over the years.
Yes.
But I've never moved. Beverly and I have only agreed once on another home, and I sold that to somebody else before we could sell our own house.
Now you don't need to move unless you're going to draw into a smaller area or a apartment or a condominium
something.
Sure.
Yeah. Most people started out with the house, you know, in the 50s, most homes were built with single garages. There's some very large homes around built in that period which had just single garages.
Well, yes. Like when I go into my neighborhood, you see, when you've been in one house 45 years
mm-hmm.
that you've built, you have a small, convenient, attached one stall garage,
one,
and my neighbors down the street all have the same thing.
Yes.
Unless right. they built big driveways and can go to the backyard.
Mm-hmm. Yours is, that's what I did. I didn't have a garage when I bought that home. I wanted to put a double. We were fortunate.
We had an attached garage immediately. See, but I noticed, I check out my neighborhood, and I find out they're either parking in their alleys, which we don't have, or they've added a garage.
Mm-hmm. And some people have put a tandem on their garage rather than side by side, their tandem end to end. But there are some houses in the design so that the house is partly behind the garage, and you don't have any way to make
change
a double garage
anything.
Out of that one.
No, you can't change any. Some of them can't be changed. Mm-hmm. Well, you were going to go on another subject here.
Well, I was thinking about some of the
builders
that... Oh, well, the appraisal process. I'm sure that hasn't changed an awful lot over the years. It's just, you know, you start out by measuring, inspecting what the features are, and you gather the information as to taxes or whether there are any special assessments against it. Then it's the lot size, which is all gathered from government. The city assessor provides you with that. Taxes you get from the treasurer. Specials you get from the city clerk or city hall. Then the next step is you start, for marketing purposes, which is really all the appraisal that I really want to do. I don't think I ever really wanted to be an appraiser. It's the same as it's always been. You then try to find the other homes that are similar to it and what it sold for. What did it sell for? How long was it on the market? And how was it financed? Because how it financed has something to do with how much money you'll get out of your property because of discount points that sellers now have to pay, it seems like, on almost all loans. There are always some points involved, one point being 1%. And if I say to you, Ruth, I have a buyer for your home, here is the offer, and they're going to take out a loan of X number of dollars, and you will be expected to pay 3 points as a discount on the mortgage. That means that if they were going to borrow $80,000 to buy your home and you had to pay 3 points, you'd be paying $2,400 to the bank for them to get a loan.
I see.
They have costs on their side. You have costs on your side, but the points are primarily a fairly new phenomena, except for the VA and FHA loans.
Mm-hmm.
VA and FHA, the law since the VA was established after the war, and FHA back in the 30s said that the seller had to pay any discount points in excess of 1%. So the
yes.
buyer was always paying 1, and their hard costs, such as appraisals, credit reports. And the seller had to pay the points. So when you talk points, primarily you're saying this is what the seller will pay. The law no longer says that the buyer can pay them, but when you talk points, it's usually a seller expense. So then I will make up a package for you showing you what other homes similar to yours, if there are any.
Yes.
What they've sold for, how long they were on the market, as I went through before.
Yes.
How they were financed. And then I try to establish a price range that your home should be priced in. The higher you go, the harder it should be to sell it. The lower you go, the easier it should
be to
sell.
Fewer people are looking at the higher priced home. I mean, there's fewer people able to look at it. Is that right?
No,
it doesn't work that way.
No. In fact, with the high price of money that we saw, as Volcker said, we won't print any more money in late 79, for a while the very expensive home was the best-selling home because those people had not yet been affected by high-priced money. They were better cash position. The beginning person is the one who really got hurt. So there is no, there right now I would say there is no best range. The little starter home has suffered, though. The government has, right or wrong, established enough programs where if you go out and buy a new little house out in a subdivision, they'll subsidize your rent, your interest. And so they've taken away some of the market on homes that I think should be very good sellers for a young couple getting started. And the draw is that the government subsidizes some of that 15% interest rate or 13% interest rate down as low as 4.5% or 6%.
Yes.
So we have young couples getting started in new homes that have I guess I'm not excited about their value because their value is created by the financing. Anyway, they'll subsidize the 13% where the buyer is only paying 4%. He can't do that buying a beginner home.
Mm-hmm.
So it's affected some of the old neighborhoods, but yet you read nationally where people are moving back into the older neighborhoods, you know, they're trying to get in closer. I don't know that that's happening here because we really aren't big enough where anybody had to go way out to the suburbs. We're practically a suburb all by ourselves.
Going way out to the suburbs.
Such as you might have done the cities, you know.
But for the size of the two cities, I think that they do move out, except it seems like the new developments are so expensive that keeps some of them out. So the young people will
tend to stay
look
in the core.
For the smaller, older home, and then hand do all the work themselves if they're handy.
Well, there's a certain amount of sweat equity, we'll call it, but again, I think most people buy a home that's finished, and they might put their own lawn in.
No, I mean repair.
In. Oh.
Move into a home that needs work. And if it's clean, they can live in it for a while until they get time to work on it, you know, things that they feel are necessary.
We saw the market was so good for so many years that almost, you know, we really ran out of homes that were the type I would call a fix-up type.
Yes.
There a certain part of the market developed where people were buying homes that needed things. Ken Murak was one. There's Don, somebody over in Fargo. But they really went around buying houses that needed maybe basement work or plumbing work, electrical work, and they were fixing them up and reselling them very quickly. It became quite a business, I would guess, in the 70s. Probably until 78, when suddenly our supply of our available housing exceeded our demand. But that the marketing of the house, I don't think has changed much in terms of setting a value, telling you what it should be. Now, when you list the home, of course, you're going to start spending money for that person. We don't get paid unless we sell the home. You know?
No.
But so we start out with our advertising. It goes into multiple. You know, we believe in a sign. I don't think there's anything changed a lot about it. We don't use television. It's too expensive. That would be one thing that could have changed since the 50s. More use of television, but we really haven't. It's too expensive.
Yes, and you have your monthly magazine.
You're right. That's
and what is the name of that?
It just says Real Estate for Sale. That's all that magazine says on it.
It's scattered all over the city. I see it every month.
Right, and
it was
so good.
I recognize the places.
We tried, and I was part of a committee. We chased people trying to get printers to set that kind of a thing up. Nobody could seem to do it. The Red River Scene couldn't, you know. Trying to make a go of it, they still couldn't. Finally, 3 years ago, a couple of realtors from Billings came in. They'd set up a few of those in cities, sold it to us, and would you believe that we've had about three people who've tried to underbid them since?
Yes.
I said, they want
it now.
Yeah, now they see, now it's been sold, the concept's been sold, so they'll try to sell it, with knowing that the realtors agree it's good. But nobody could seem to want to sell it back when we were trying to sell it for somebody to get somebody to sell it to us, but it's a good device.
Yes, I like it very, very much, and I recognize many, many houses and many, many addresses because I've been here so long, and it's a thing that when you look at what Howard Binford has done with his magazine, what's the name of that now?
The Guide.
Guide. Howard Binford's Guide. Yep. People look for that. You know, our time is, we're using our time.
Oh, good.
But I've enjoyed it so very, very much. But I would like to ask, is there any particular home in Moorhead that stands out? I could mention Dr. Knutson. It's now Dr. Dovery's old home.
That was the Huntoon.
That was built by Huntoon in 1900.
Hmm. Well, I would,
and that is beautiful piece of property, and it will always stay that way.
It was interesting watching them thatch that roof again, wasn't it?
Now mention the roof.
It was called an English thatched roof, I think.
Yes.
And to look at that shingle laid in there in wavering, undulating layers, I didn't sit out in the street and watch them put it in, but they had a steamer. There was a steamer, you know, in the yard, and they were steaming those shingles to fit that undulation and curve as you came to peaks, and it really is a beautiful roof. I wish shingles stayed yellow, gold and shiny like that, because they're very pretty when they before
they weather.
But they
are to be weathered with age, aren't they?
Well,
they will weather.
If you put something on them, I think they will weather much nicer.
Yes.
Some shingled roofs get quite rough up there. They're doing a good job of shedding water, but I think the ones that are treated some way at the beginning seem to stand up better. That's just my imagination.
Well,
nobody's ever told me that.
The cedar shingles are usually dipped in solution.
I had a cedar roof put on 2 years ago, and it just came right out of the lumber yard, and they put it up there. There was no, there was nothing dipped before they put it up in the roof.
But years ago they dipped.
Did they really? They had time to do that.
For color.
Huh.
Well, I have enjoyed this very much, Jim, and for this interesting and informative discussion on real estate. And is there anything else you'd like to add to this?
Well, I think, you know, I don't know how widely distributed or listened to this will be, but basically, since 1953, when I started in the business, when there was a shortage of housing, there have only been two periods that were slow, really, in real estate. About 1960, the town Fargo and Moorhead, the Northwest Fargo, got built up to the... We got a little overbuilt. They started building some apartment houses, and there were people who never had a choice except to buy, since they came back from the service, who suddenly said, I think I'll rent for a while. And we saw some houses sitting. Interest rates, incidentally, had gotten up too high. They'd gotten up to about 6 3/4, and I think they tried to go to 7% about late 59 or early 60. That slowed things down, and a lot of builders struggled until about 63 or 4. And I know I was telling my friends who were builders, I said, I think you can start building this year, because I could see just watch the inventory on multiple, you know, and you knew that there were fewer things available. So about 64, things took off. Money got very tight in 68, 78. That slowed us down a little. Right through the 70s, if there were any national recessions, we didn't know it locally. And I don't think any business locally really knew it. But in 1979, when Volcker and the Federal Reserve, inventory caught up to demand in 78. And then I think Volcker's... And the Federal Reserve decision not to print money slowed things down. And I, in my mind, his foot on the brake too long. I think he caused a lot of the present pain by, instead of easing up on money in late 81, he waited till probably August of 82. Mm-hmm. So I think there was a little excess pain put on, but it certainly curbed inflation. I mean, the inflationary thought that everything just automatically went up. I don't know you know, some of the builders that I dealt with, we really had great builders, I think, in Moorhead and Fargo.
Great builders.
Builders.
Yes.
You know, we had very little track-type building. Almost everything built
was
basically a custom-type builder. Now, there are some that I'm not excited about, but if you look at what Kwame built, Twin City Construction, who got to be very big, Van Raden, Rudy Leonard, Leveld and McDonald, Vic Schramm.
And there were the Ides.
Leonard Ide built more of a track-type house.
Yes, that's right, he did.
And the
lots
Jackson Company built a track-type. And they certainly created, you know, homes for people who needed them. But Matt Sandy and son, Ed Welly.
Hanson Brothers,
you bet. Lundy out now. And we even had a little builder came in, and he was a little ahead of his time, a guy named Ed Searcy. He called himself Key Builders. Les Watson sold him some land, and he built a series of different models. But he was in that period of 62 or 63. He was like a year or two ahead of the market. And, you know, he finally left town, I think, the middle of the night, and it's too bad. If he'd have started 2 years, Ed Searcy, if he just went broke, and if he started 2 years later, he'd have been way out ahead of everybody because he had good floor plans and was building a good house for a very modest price. So, Oxness, you remember? Stan and...
Stan.
Was Charlie or Gordon?
Stan Oxness.
Stan Oxness, his brother.
Yes.
Arlo Bulin built a lot of homes. He finished up building a lot up north. But we really had good builders.
Yes.
Quality started arriving about the time I came in, I think, came into the business, about 53. The materials were getting very competitive, but very good. We started seeing all birch, all oak, you know, for trim doors, things like that. Furnaces that had been a real problem. I know Andy, your husband, tells about putting some furnaces together with just parts. You couldn't
get
the furnace. But all of a sudden, we started seeing excellent furnaces around 53 and 54.
Yes.
Wiring standards went up. You know, we started seeing 100 amp services. Everything just, the homes built, I thought, Ruth, from 54 to, say, 60 were just excellent houses. Just really, nowadays when I show you one and you don't like it, it's because of colors. It's inlays that are allowed to get old. You know, carpeting is allowed to get old. Appliances are allowed to get old. Bathrooms that are allowed to get old. But if those homes are updated, they're great houses. Like Van Raden says, you can't get the lumber. You can't even get the kind of lumber that went into those houses now.
Yes.
It would be too expensive.
But I think when you find a home like that, I'm thinking in terms of young people. If they get a little educated into what the house has to offer, they'll preserve what's in there rather than modernize to the point or so-called jazz it up so that it loses its individuality.
Well, you hope they don't tear out good things.
That's right.
To update.
Because, you know, the generations before them lived with it. If they modernize, that's fine. But they really shouldn't destroy the traditional part of something.
Yeah, well, one of the things I think that many homes could be improved on now from what was built in, I think windows have just improved tremendously.
Oh, yes.
You know, now you have your clad windows, and they're sometimes they're treated water-resistant. They don't show stains. You know, you've all gone in the houses where the frost in the summer, in the winter.
Right.
Turns to ice, thaws, rots, ruins the wood.
It's like a little refrigerator. But that means you have to replace windows.
Yes. And
but it's a good investment.
Yeah, I think so. And I'm kind of a window freak.
We've been
good windows.
Know, yeah.
You bet. It's kind of fun to run a window up and down or crank it open and have it work.
Well, thank you, Jim, for a very, very interesting
You're sure welcome.
Time.
I hope it fills in a space somewhere.
And I think we will close our interview.
All right.